Hey, everybody. Welcome to That Triathlon Life podcast. I'm Eric Lagerstrom.
I'm Paula Finley.
I'm Nick Goldston.
And we are no longer all together in the same place. Nick, I don't know what you were, how you were able to do it, but Nick stayed at our house for a week after staying with his parents in New York for a week and was just like living this transient lifestyle, which made it amazing. And we were able to do did two podcast episodes, our celebratory 100th podcast episode and podcast 101. We're 102. We're back to the normal routine here on FaceTime. And I think actually the audio quality is going to be better because Paul and I are both like right up on these mics.
Finally. I feel like we've had some ups and downs with Paul. Paula's like, she's a very dynamic podcast host. She's all over the place. She's up
You're
and down.
You're
calling
me a podcast host? Should I put that on my Instagram profile?
What would you consider yourself here? A guest? Every week for
Nick,
every
you're asking
single
me the
episode?
You're hosting me every week.
Paula's a professional personality.
I just show up, sit in this comfy chair. You guys give me all my things
Eric's
I need.
Eric's sitting in a torture device right now, but Paula has blankets and pillows on her chair with a nice back on it.
Anyway, we're going to forge on here. Paula and I are both professional triathletes. Nick is a amateur triathlete, professional musician, Grammy winner, great friend of ours, and we feel qualified to talk about triathlon things on this podcast because of Paul and my long history in the sport, and Nick brings a really interesting everyman, if you will, perspective to it.
Okay, so speaking of which, I have the spoiled life of living in Los Angeles, and the weather here has been great, and I've been riding outside, no problems, whereas you guys got like, I mean, how much snow is on the ground now? Over 2 feet of snow.
Yeah, easily over 2 feet.
So what have you been doing to survive? Can you even drive to the pool?
We can drive to the pool, no problem. We have a snow tank.
Oh, that thing. Studded winter tires, four-wheel drive.
It is the most fun. Yeah, we have an FJ Cruiser with some fantastic snow tires with studs that I got off Facebook Marketplace, probably my favorite website. And it's been treating us right.
Yeah, okay. All year I want to sell the FJ, but then when the ice and snow comes, it's the best car of all time.
Yeah, it's like the perfect thing where it's like a pretty nice car and the heater blasts incredibly, but it's not so nice that we're not afraid to, you know, if someone were to bump into us versus driving our beautiful van across town when people are slipping and sliding all over the place. That's pretty scary.
So that being said, I imagine you're still not riding bikes outside and there's no end in sight to that, or has that changed?
I have been looking at Facebook Marketplace fat bikes.
Oh,
that would be the only way one would ride outside right now.
And would you throw a power meter on there somehow, or would you just kind of go by feel and just try to get your longer aerobic rides done on the fat bike?
I think I would just go by lactate.
Okay, you're gonna bring a lactate tester out there with you?
Yeah,
there was a question about this today.
I put it in.
Bring some strips. And you know, like pull off my gloves and like do a little finger prick on the side of the road.
Perfect. If it doesn't turn into an icicle.
Yeah, gravel truck goes by.
Well, to be serious here, you guys, we're training on Zwift a lot, which is a fine. It's just part of winter training. I think it makes you really strong. Yes, of course, ideally we'd be riding outside more, but Bend is the kind of place where 2 weeks ago we were riding on trails. And now it's covered in snow. And like, I think in 10 days, it could melt enough that the roads are dry again. So it really is just like the nature of winter. And we have been living like this all our lives. So it's okay. And we're not alone. There's so many people on the West Coast or like, you know, north in the USA that are dealing with the same thing. So it's kind of just how it goes.
Yeah. It's been really pretty though. I'm not hating the snow pics that I've been taking.
And you are able to run, right? But to what extent are you able to run?
Yeah, I mean it's a mix because some days it's actually quite warm out, but the ground is really snowy and a bit slippery, so you just have to be extra careful. And the way that I treat it is a bit like trail running, where paces don't really matter. You have to be extra careful, but I actually do think it adds an element of stability and strength work a little bit. Without even meaning to, because the snow is a bit unstable and it's not like you're hitting a predictably flat ground every footstep. So you're kind of getting thrown off a bit. So I actually think it's good for this time of year when we're kind of just doing base miles anyway. Like I'm still breathing really heavy, but just not running an impressive pace. So it's just kind of the nature of snow running.
Right when we were running in the snow for the first couple of times, I remember telling Eric like, oh, my calves are sore. And it kind of caught me off guard. And I'm sure it was from the uneven surface thing. Then it must have some strength aspect. Eric has alluded to this many times in the past, how for him, trail running kind of strengthens those muscles, and he finds it to be very helpful for him.
Yeah, yeah. Running the snow, particularly, it's like halfway to running in sand. But then, you know, it's like if you're running in sand that some of it was soft and some of it was hard, you know, and you just never knew when you're gonna put your foot down. That's snow running, and it is incredible workout for your proprioceptors. You know, and definitely like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So as long as you don't break your ankle, they're going to be stronger.
And then if you fall, you fall into the snow. So that is, it's not bad either.
Or a chunk of ice, either way. You know, it's just, that's just, you know.
The downside is like if it's too cold, like today it was minus 15 Celsius. That's really rare for Bend, but that's where I think you get into the territory of potentially getting injured. Like I took a couple wrong steps and slipped and like felt like my hamstring kind of get tweaked, and that's where your muscles are not warm. So
I see.
The whole time I'm running, I'm thinking like, am I even getting anything out of this? Or I'm just like completely risking getting an injury for barely any benefit. And that's where you have to make the call of if the treadmill is a better choice on that day.
And you guys don't hate the treadmill so much, right?
Or I Eric, don't I like which the treadmill. One. I don't use the word hate ever, Nick. I don't know if you noticed.
I love that. That's a good New Year's resolution, actually.
That's a great New Year's resolution.
But I do prefer to avoid the treadmill at all costs.
To my core, avoid the treadmill.
I've talked about this on the podcast before. I can Zwift forever, all day on the bike.
That's what it was, yeah.
But then on the treadmill, I get this like panicky feeling where it feels hard and I'm not going anywhere and I feel like kind of sick and woozy. And even if I'm running slow, it feels like I'm doing a tempo run. It's really challenging for me. Anyway.
Yeah.
I don't
mind it for some reason. It's like kind of zen and I just zone out. But can't do the trainer. I'm the opposite. Zwift is, Zwift is incredible and has been life-changing, but riding the trainer is just a struggle.
I do wonder what the scope, what triathlon would look like without something like Zwift. How different would bike times be?
We all grew up like that, Nick, before you started the sport.
Well, yeah, but now, I mean, now is it a coincidence? I mean, I'm sure it's at least partially a coincidence that the biking is fast, like so much faster than it was even 5 years ago. Are those two things related?
I'm not going to, no comment.
I'm not going to say that's because of Zwift, but.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors.
But man, maybe it's one of them. It definitely makes it easier to do a 3-hour ride.
Yeah, there's probably like more people that are fast now. The people that, are just afraid of the outside or don't have access to it that have been able to ride Zwift and get strong. Like someone who has beautiful roads out the back door.
Right. Okay. Well, first thing we're going to do is a little bike tech with Eric. Bike tech with Eric! We haven't done this in a while, but this is a great question. Congrats on the 100th episode. I have a question about inner tubes. Should I go for old school butyl, latex, or TPU, or tubeless? For background info, I'm training for Challenge Roth and have very limited bike tech skills. The most important thing for me is that I have to think as little as possible about my tires, not much maintenance, few flats. Thanks so much for all your great podcasts. They've been super helpful in my triathlon journey. Best, Emma from the Netherlands. So Emma said, my question is about inner tubes. Should I go for old school? So let's answer two questions here. First one, if you're doing inner tubes, what do you think the best material is for those inner tubes?
Back in the day, I would always train on butyl, which is just a little bit heavier and a little less, a little higher rolling resistance and everything, and then switch over to latex for racing, which is, latex is like what's in the highest end tubulars and everything. And what was the third one? TPU?
Yeah.
Is that like the super thin, like almost see-through clear ones?
I actually don't know what that is. I'm only familiar
with butyl. Why are we even talking about tubes anymore?
We're just trying to, Nick said, let's assume that we're talking about tubes.
I'll tell you why, because my road bike, for example, is not, those wheels are not tubeless compatible. So I have no choice but to run tubes in those.
Yeah. So that's what I used to do. And so that's still the only thing that I can recommend, not knowing exactly TPU. And all it's,
I did the same thing. I used the thick ones for training and then switched to latex for racing. Yeah. And I also would switch the tires for racing too. So you're kind of just like redoing the whole wheel setup for a race.
Yeah,
100%. Which in ITU racing is quite often.
Eric, when you gave me the disc wheel, actually it was Paula's disc wheel, there was a latex tube in there.
Nick, I gave you the disc wheel.
You did.
Every time you see it, you should say Paula gave me the disc.
No, you're right. I just, the reason I said that is because I remember asking Eric what kind of tube was in there because I thought he might know since he put it in there.
Yeah, because it is it's not a tubeless disc.
No. Yeah.
Right. But let's say that you aren't stuck with just tubes. I really think that tubeless is less maintenance, less flats, faster. It's better in all the ways with the exception of the setup time. And if you have a shop nearby that will do your tubeless setup for you, then you have zero setup time.
I will say anecdotally, I don't know if you guys remember how hard of a time I had setting up the tubeless tires on my TT bike with the DT Swiss wheels. Horrible. I literally had to, when I was done with them, I took them to two different bike shops to try to get them on. And initially, neither one of them could do it. I had to take them off with a razor blade. I had to cut them off. That was the only way I could get them off. I just set up a set of tubeless wheels for someone the other day, and I almost was able to get the tires on there by myself, just with my hands.
Are the DT Swiss wheels you had not tubeless compatible or something? Like, why would that happen?
No, they totally were. I think what Eric said to me when it was happening, his opinion was that this was like at the beginning of tubeless stuff. So it was the Conti GP5000 tubeless, like the first round of them. And I think even the DT Swiss wheels were like early on, and they were so scared that the bead would pop off the rim or something, that the tolerances were made extremely tight.
You got them on but couldn't get them off.
I barely got them on. Barely got them on. And yes, getting them off, I just could not do it.
This is not an endorsement of early DT Swiss tubeless. Supposedly tubeless compatible. Modern day stuff should be no problem.
It was zero problem. I popped it on there. It was literally easier than an inner tube wheel.
You are just admitting how incredibly right I was and that your wheels were very strange, angry unicorns.
Yes.
And most tubeless wheels are not a problem to set up.
The stem just threaded on there, put sealant in, put the valve core in, and pumped it up with the valve core in, and the tire seated perfectly and immediately. Yeah. It was no problem at all.
Like the last five sets of zip wheels that I've set up, exact same story. Don't even need a canister.
Yeah, the only downside that you didn't mention, I'd say, is that it does lose air like overnight much quicker than inner tubes do. So you just, in my opinion, you just have to pump up before every ride, which is something that a lot of us already do anyway with inner tubes, but with tubeless for sure.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you should always be checking your tire pressure just in case.
Yeah, so we all love tubeless tires for sure. All my bikes that can do it. All of your bikes do it, period, right? So good luck, Emma, but we definitely endorse tubeless tires. Just make sure that both your wheels and the tires you are using are tubeless compatible. Okay, let's move on to questions. And you too can submit your questions for this podcast at thattriathlonlife.com/podcast. There's also a bunch of stuff that we produce on there, t-shirts, hats. We got more stuff coming up the pipeline soon. And you can also become a podcast supporter there. That helps us keep the podcast going. As you can tell, we don't do ad reads on the podcast, so we rely on that. Thank you so much to all our podcast supporters. Every week, we try to randomly pick one podcast supporter that we give a bottle to. And this week, we used our random number generator and found Lucas Schoenfeld. You won. You won a bottle. Congratulations. And thank you for being a podcast supporter. Just make sure you message me on Instagram or find me somehow and give me your current address, and we'll send that bottle to you right away.
I just got to say, because as I was going through the supporter list and like doing the number generator and everything, how many other podcasts out there give away something to people every single week?
Eric, are you patting yourself on the back?
I want to brag. And I'm not trying to pat ourselves on the back, but I'm just saying that is freaking cool. You know, like when I listen to a lot of podcasts, I have to like skip through like 40 minutes of ad reads and stuff is, you know, reading a script. And what are we doing? We're giving away water bottles.
I'm having flashbacks to going to like film festivals and stuff, and you're like a raffle. And even if there's like 1,000 people in the theater, you're like, I have a chance of winning. I am going to win. I don't think I've personally ever won a raffle or a draw or a random number generator, but the hope is always there. So it's kind of fun. You never know.
I hope it's fun.
I was at a volleyball game once with my brother, and they were raffling off free tickets. And they're like, and the free ticket winner is, and I just turned to him, and I go, I guarantee you I won these tickets. And they go, Nick Goldston. And I walked right down and got him. He thought I was from the future or something. Yeah, I don't know. I just, I could feel it. I was tingling.
That is a cool story.
Eric, you're right. It's cool that we do this. And you know what? No one could tell us it's not cool because it's just the three of us talking and this is a one-way street.
Honestly, the biggest pain with it is like us, TTL staff, going to the freaking post office and putting them in mailers and addressing them. And it's a big thing.
Yeah, so if you get one of these bottles, it's Paula's handwriting on the envelope. Like, it's not someone in some factory somewhere getting paid minimum wage.
Well, I am getting paid minimum wage.
No, you're getting paid below minimum wage. Yeah, this is free labor.
Okay, let's move on to the real questions.
Okay, first question here is from Trisha. Hello, TTL crew. For starters, thank you for all the wealth of knowledge you have provided me over the past year. I have a question regarding those who are visually impaired and the challenges with swimming. I'm a daily contact wearer with an astigmatism, aka expensive lenses, and cannot see further than 20 feet without my contacts. I worry about eye infections from the lake bacteria or destruction to the contacts from chlorine and chemical exposure in the pool. I try to get my goggles as tightly sealed as possible, but there always seems to be a little water that sneaks in. My eye clinic helped me out last year with a 2-week sample pack for daily lenses that I could throw away after swimming in the lake. But since they're so expensive, it's not something I can do on the regular. Wondering if you have any experience or know others with contact lens use and swimming. Risk an infection and hope your goggles stay tightly sealed. Any recs on goggles that are great for this? Consider prescription strength goggles. Get LASIK. Quit swimming. Any suggestions on this would be helpful. Thank you, Trisha. I say quit swimming, but I'll let Paula answer this question since I think I know what she's going to say.
Yeah, well, you know what I'm going to say, but I think with this with an astigmatism, you can't just get LASIK.
That's too bad because that's what I have.
I think it's more complicated than that. What?
That's too bad because that's what I have.
You have what?
An astigmatism.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an ophthalmologist or optometrist or whatever you call them, but I think that not everyone is a candidate for LASIK. I personally had LASIK in 2012 before the 2012 Olympics. LASIK was a sponsor of mine, so I didn't pay for it, but it truly is the best thing. Maybe like top five best things I've ever done for myself because I have not had an issue with my vision since. And anyone who wears glasses or contacts or has not perfect sight, I think it's a worthwhile investment. Before I had LASIK, I wore daily contacts, which I realize are expensive, but I think on days where you're swimming, you should go for the dailies and throw them out. Maybe you don't swim every day. Hopefully you don't swim every day. So maybe you could just save the dailies for the times where you are going to the pool or to the lake or doing a race. But I really think that risking an eye infection is not worth wearing the same lenses day after day when you're swimming every day.
I have a quick question because I'm just uneducated. How much does LASIK cost? And now knowing your experience, how much would you pay?
Oh, what's wow.
That? So Paula, you answer the question first and then I'll tell you how much it costs. And I'm also going to tell you about the astigmatism with LASIK.
I don't know how much it costs now. I think maybe back then it was maybe 5,000 Canadian.
Okay.
But
per eye or total?
It was total. And let me tell you, the process is so fast and painless and the recovery is extremely quick. I think I took a week out of the pool and I wore like sunglasses outside, but it's a really unintrusive surgery. How much would I pay now? 20.
Wow.
Or more.
Wow. 20.
This is just so like incredible and fascinating to me. You know, like imagining having blurry vision and then just all of a sudden in the course of one day being able to see is just...
I mean, it wasn't like I was going from blurry to clear. Like I wore contacts every day. Mm. But what really makes me feel like I would do it for a lot of money is that in 3 WTS races, which I ended up winning, my contact fell out in the swim. So I was literally racing the race with like weird, obscure vision. And it was like not that safe on the bike. So I was like, I need to put an end to this. There's got to be a solution. I think having prescription goggles might be a good solution for this person if daily contacts are truly not affordable, but...
And then you would like put contacts in T1?
No, this person, like, wear dailies for a race, but for day-to-day swim training, maybe wear the prescription goggles.
Oh, okay.
The crazy thing about ITU swimming is it's so rough that even getting knocked a bit in the face would cause the contact lens to pop out of my goggles.
Really?
Yeah, so that's... Those are the situations where I'd lose a lens. I wouldn't lose a lens in swimming training every day.
Right, right.
So anyway, Nick, how much does it cost and can you get it with an astigmatism?
First of all, what we need to get is like a LASIK code so that we make money, because I think we just sold hundreds of LASIK surgeries with your endorsement.
Oh, I don't know about that.
First of all, you can get LASIK if you have an astigmatism. There may be a limit to if your astigmatism is really bad.
Yeah, I think they just have to like go and see if you're a candidate.
That's exactly
right. I remember doing that, going in for an appointment and making sure it was
possible. When I was Googling stuff, that was like everything said that you have to be a candidate. You have to see if you're a candidate. But on this website, which I found, which I don't know how reliable it is, but it looks legit, MacyEyeCenter.com, LASIK costs on average, a life-changing procedure costs around $2,200 for one eye and $4,400 for both eyes, with costs determined by several factors. So this is in Los Angeles. So that's well under $20,000.
Wow, I really, really,
yeah,
really overpaid.
And it's well under $5,000. That's well under $5,000 Canadian too.
That's probably about $5,000 Canadian. I don't know, $4,400 US.
That is, oh, let's see.
I'm gonna say that's $3,700.
$3,700 American is $5,000 Canadian as of today.
Okay.
So yeah, not so bad. That's not so bad. That would be worth it. That's something I'm going to consider as well, because I have my glasses, but it would be really nice to not have them.
Cool. Yeah. Good luck.
Especially riding, honestly. Like mountain biking, when the things right in front of you matter a lot, or trail running after dusk, which is something I do all the time.
Yeah,
I would just, on the goggles though, I would just go for like someone with a bigger gasket and then really experiment with the different nose pieces that come with goggles to find the one that, you know, makes the leaking the least.
Yep. Okay. Next question here is from Andy. Oh, from Northern Germany. I love the video about the wetsuit testing. Oh, speaking of which, that was our latest video on the That Triathlon Life YouTube channel. Really cool. Eric took three different wetsuits, a Roka wetsuit, top of the line Roka, an Orca wetsuit and a Zone 3 wetsuit, and did as a scientific test as we could, 4 100s with the same leaving time and tried to do the same effort.
I'll just run through it. Basically, we did 4 100s with each suit. I did not see what time I came in on, but then after about 10 seconds, I would look up and make sure that I left on the 130. So these are 100 long course meters. And then at the end of each four with a suit, I would take it off as quick as I could, seeing how fast and if there were any issues, any hangups. And then I put on the next suit and did this and repeated this test. So I did the Roka, the Zone 3, the Orca, and then I went back to the Roka again just for control to see, basically trying to determine, like, I like the feel of all these. Does anyone feel harder than the others? And do the times confirm that one is faster or slower? And it was really cool. Nick filmed it.
Without giving away any of the results, because we want people to watch the video, is there anything that that would like kind of surprised you, or that you want to share that's not going to spoil anything?
I would just say that what I thought was happening, you know, if you would have said like, which one of these do you think was fastest and which one were you working harder to swim in? I was wrong.
That's great. I love that. Yeah, really cool. Okay, sorry. Back to the question from Andy here. I have a question about wetsuits. Do you have any experience with the durability of different wetsuit brands? And also, how tight should it really be? Would you recommend using the bigger or smaller size if you sit in between two sizes? Best from Northern Germany, Andy.
That's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
They're all pretty fragile, I'd say.
Yeah. I mean, like really the key is to have your fingernails clipped and then try to always pull up the wetsuit using like the pads of your fingers. I'm like, you know, making a motion to Paula and Nick in the FaceTime, which is useless to everybody listening. But instead of like thinking like grabbing onto it with your fingernails, try to do it, you know, with the centers of the pads of your fingers. You'll kind of get the hang of it.
I said they're fragile, but I've actually never really torn a wetsuit by pulling it up. So maybe I just am careful with it, but they do have some durability.
Yeah.
And the places that are maybe a little bit more fragile are like the arms where it's really thin.
People tend...
The armpits
are where I've had holes.
Yeah. I mean, you get those from stretching, but the place that we had the most fingernail holes back when I worked in the triathlon shop was in the legs. People are just like trying to pull up the legs and
yanking.
Most, I know it's not anything against women, but more often than not, it was women because they just would.
Not like, anything clap, against women.
Like they have fingernails, you know, like men tend to have smaller fingernails. So anything you can do to not get your fingernails into the neoprene, wherever you're pulling it up, and just don't try to put on your wetsuit 3 minutes before the start. Give yourself a lot of time.
Have you guys ever used that neoprene glue kind of stuff or it's like a repair for
Yeah, that does suits? Work.
It works, I had to use it last year.
I spent hours with that on our rental fleet.
at the shop.
Yep.
Yeah, that really does work if you get a hole in your wetsuit. And often when you get a little hole, the rest of the wetsuit's totally fine. You don't want to have to go buy a new one. So that wetsuit glue is really nice.
Yep.
In terms of the sizing, I would say that it's kind of like an old wives' tale that like tighter is better. Because if it's too tight, you really feel constricted and it's hard to breathe. And on the flip side, if it's too loose, you get water in it and it is not as fast. But I would almost, if you're in between sizes, go one up. I don't know. Is that bad advice?
I would say go down.
With the DeBoer, we both sized up like two sizes. It was absolutely insane. But most of the time, I'm a small and I stay with a small. And also they have like small tall a lot of the time or medium tall.
Yeah.
So there's different lengths. And often I find that like the size charts on the websites are pretty accurate. Would you say, Eric?
Yeah.
Aside from DeBoer.
Yeah. I would say 99% of the time they are pretty accurate. I'm always a medium. So some companies have a small and a small medium and a medium. Some companies have a small and a small tall and then a medium. Yeah. And all often, like in Blue 70, I was between the small and the medium. So I did the small tall. I was out of the range of height on the small tall, but I was over the weight. So I basically just like filled the suit out sideways instead of vertically.
You can always cut the legs.
It stretches a bit. It stretches.
You can always cut the legs. That's the thing, Nick. They are pretty flexible. So if they are a little bit too tight, like it does loosen up over time as you wear it a little bit and get it wet, it'll loosen up a bit. So if you first put it on, it feels tight, that's probably okay. Where it's not okay is if it's like hard to breathe and you feel panicked.
Okay, so I pulled up two different wetsuits, the Roka top-of-the-line wetsuit and the Blue 70 top-of-the-line wetsuit. And under their fit tips, first of all, Roka says the suit should feel tight, but if it constricts your breathing or restricts shoulder movement in the water, then you need to size up. So that kind of goes along with what you're saying. But then the Blue 70 site says, start with your weight, then match your height. Like you were saying, that's kind of the chart there. If your weight falls across multiple sizes, use your height to determine the best one. If your height and weight are both on the border between two sizes, choose a larger size for a more comfortable fit or the smaller size for better performance, but a tighter fit.
Yeah, I mean—
That's great wording.
That's good wording, yeah.
So that's, I mean— You guys struggled hard with the breathing thing, and that feels like that's number one priority. If you can't breathe well, like the rest of it doesn't even come into play.
Yeah, one should not be having a panic attack prior to diving into the water.
Yeah.
Next.
All right, Andy, hopefully that helps. Next question is from Grant. Hi, Nick, Paula, Eric. I'm training for my first triathlon, Xterra, New Jersey Olympic distance.
Let's go.
Yeah.
My God.
After a year of picking up lap swimming as an adult, I finally feel like I have a good enough fitness base that I'll be able to handle the needed endurance of the sport. That said, I have no experience whatsoever open water swimming. How do I find good places to try swimming? It feels easy to find cycling and running groups on Strava, but can't find any open water swimming groups near me. It seems like lakes near me have swimming areas, but in pictures don't seem big enough for long workout swims. I'd also want to be with a group of more experienced swimmers for safety. Thanks in advance. I have a very difficult year with terrible losses of loved ones, and triathlon training has been a great escape. Thanks for your company on my workouts. Cheers, Grant.
I don't think you need to do as much open water practice as you think. I think a lot of people probably do none, and they're fine.
I would say slightly more than none is probably a good amount.
Slightly more than none. What I think is even at the race, on race week, say you get there 2 days early or 3 days early, getting in that water is probably good enough.
That would stress me out.
Yeah, but if you don't have any other option, you're going
to
be fine.
I think Grant has an option. It's just he might have to swim back and forth in 100 meters, which I think is totally fine to get the feel of the wetsuit and everything. You can still practice sighting and looking up and seeing the same thing each time and getting the feel for the direction. And ideally, yes, get a couple of friends out there and swim side by side and get a little bit of feel for getting bumped back and forth. But you can also accomplish that in a pool. So I would say 100 meters, 50 meters, even if you have to go back and forth, just get the feel of the wetsuit and make sure that that is not a thing that's keeping you up at night.
Yeah.
That's sufficient.
Yeah, practicing with the wetsuit is important. But also, you'll be fine if you don't do it, is my opinion. And as you do more races, like you get more comfortable with it, you won't even think twice.
Here's my opinion as someone who swam with a wetsuit for the first time in the past 10 years, which neither of you have that experience. You were both, first of all, very good swimmers on top of all that. But I think, what do you guys think about, even if he can't swim with a wetsuit, open water, bring it to the pool a couple of times just to get used to that feeling first?
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. You cannot show up on race day and not know if it fits.
Right. Or race week, you know, like yeah. Taking advantage of that. But the other thing is, I think there's probably not a lot of open water swimming groups, but I think there's a good chance there's a triathlon group that you can be a part of, be a member of, and they will organize open water swims, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Or even just like one or two other people around you.
Yeah.
You could also go on to either... Yeah, I think that Triathlon Life Strava Club has quite a few people commenting on there, and you could go on there and say, "Hey, I live in such and such. Does anybody want to go for an open water swim? Might have some luck."
I think it's a good idea to practice with people, because I remember being surprised at how much I do not swim in a straight line unless I'm sighting quickly enough, often enough. And then if you're used to seeing a line at the bottom of the pool, seeing nothing but blackness is a little disorienting.
Kind of scary. Yeah, totally.
So that's good practice to get in. At least that was helpful for me. Finally, I think those, you guys never swim with these, but the inflatable little pull buoys behind you, that adds a level of feeling safe and visibility, but also like
we
you
use
can just
those
like,
sometimes.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
When we're not swimming in the river where there are no motorboats allowed. But if we go somewhere where it's a little bigger and motorboats or, you know, we'll do it then.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's going to be okay,
yeah, those
Grant.
Are great.
It's going to be okay. You're going to do great. And we're very excited. We would love to hear how you do at Xterra, New Jersey. That's going to be fun. Next one here is from David. And these are two questions, but both are really good questions. Hi, founders, which might be a new one.
I accept.
I'm late to the party, but I think I have caught up and consumed your most excellent podcasts and YouTube videos. I have to say, you do live, train, and race at some beautiful locations. I hope one day I'll get to check out some of them in person. I have a few questions I've built up, and I would be grateful if you could answer any one of them. Do you have any lactate testing as part of your training? If not, why? Or if yes, how frequently, and have you seen real-world results using it? So let's start with that. Eric joked about it early on, but what's the truth?
We do lactate tests. It's not even really a test, but we do go do bike testing one or two times a year. And the physiologist uses the strips just to like measure the lactate threshold, like when it spikes up. And then we take those power data and that heart rate data and use it for training. But we're not taking lactate strips to training day to day.
The way that we see the Norwegians or a lot of people do.
Yeah, we've never done that. Like we don't have our own lactate meter or the strips or any of that stuff. Two of the guys that we swim with did lactate testing in the pool today, something we've never done, but they were doing like 400 repeats, getting out, pricking their fingers, testing their lactate. I don't know. To me, I just don't understand it enough for it to be a valuable tool, and I don't want to do it, so... That makes it easy.
Yeah. Our coach, Paulo, does understand it, and he has not recommended it to us. It's just, there are a lot of variables and a lot of, I think that what makes it work for the Norwegians pretty well is that they've been doing it for so long. They have such a body of data that to them, 3.1, and then on the next rep, they were 3.3. Like that means a lot to them versus us. It's like, oh, well, you know, X, Y, and Z could have made that happen outside of just like my effort level. You know, a little bit how we talk about heart rate is great, but also if you didn't sleep well and you're underhydrated and everything, it can kind of throw it. So
definitely adds a layer of stress to workouts that are already stressful because they're hard. So I think that the way to execute it properly is to have like a coach with you or someone to help you execute the session where you're doing that. And Eric and I, when we go do hard sessions, we're both doing the hard session. So right. We don't have someone on deck or whatever, in a car following us on the bike to do it. We just kind of keep things simple and it's worked for us so far.
Yeah. And Nick, you might know more, but like, correct me if I'm wrong. The Norwegians, it's not like every session of every day they're testing, but due to social media, obviously that's like an interesting thing to take pictures of. So I think it probably disproportionately looks like they're doing it a lot more than they even are, but they're checking in on it periodically. It's not like every swim, every bike, every run, they're going completely based on that.
It's also like, this kind of leads to the question I was going to ask you, but I guess I'll just answer it myself. Because the point is to understand what an effort's physiological effect on you is. So it's not going to change from a Monday to a Tuesday if you're running, right? You can check in like, okay, right now, 3 or 4 minutes per K this is the effect it's having on my lactate. So now I know that and I can train accordingly or race accordingly in regards to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think our friend at the pool this morning was like, when you're doing an Ironman, you want to stay at about a 2.0 or something, whatever that means. And to him, that means something. And he knows that, okay, if I'm swimming 120s per 100, I'm at a 2.0. And this is what 120s feels like. So when I'm doing a 20 by 100 at race pace, I should be going this. Like, it just gives more data to execute training well, if that's a tool you use, which we do not.
You know, I think you could somewhat equate it to how people try to use their heart rate threshold compared to their effort.
Yeah, another tool. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally.
And then the second question here, I love this question. And you guys are the perfect people to ask this. Why, in your opinion, don't you see many, if not any, retired pros competing as age groupers? Do you reckon you'll still compete after you retire? So let's answer that first one there. Why not? You know, I see plenty of 50, 40, 60-year-old people competing in triathlon. I mean, that's extremely common. Are we not seeing pros doing that because it's bad form, because it's sandbagging, or because they're like, I exhausted all my triathlon racing.
I cannot walk anymore.
It's over, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Good question.
I think there are a lot of factors to it, but I think for me, you know, we've been doing this for so long and trying so hard at it. And I think by the time that we've retired, we're making that decision because we've reached our peak and we're going to want a little bit of a break at the very least. And even if, you know, you didn't take a break, you're still burdened with the memory of how fast you once were. And that's just going to get worse and worse. So like in my mind, it seems more fun to go take on a new challenge where there might be some improvements left to still have versus I'm just kind of like slowly watching myself get old as indicated by my finishing times, you know?
Yeah, you'd have to, it's some serious ego work to be able to still do that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think by the time people retire, you really should be ready to be like letting go of the amount of training and work it takes to be good at it. Like I definitely, for one, won't be going to the pool very often when I retire. We're kind of like in the grind right now and it's for good reason. But once I retire, I think it's, it would be maybe not as fun to go back and not be as fast as you were. And like Eric said, other goals, other things you want to try, trail running, gravel riding, still being active, skiing more, hanging out with your family more. I don't know. There's so many other things.
Yeah. To like give a little bit of context, like we do not have weekends. Like our lives we're on all the time. And yes, we have the luxury to go to the coffee shop in between workouts. But for the most part, like I've gotten like 12 texts in the last week from friends like, oh my gosh, powder day. It's so good up there. And I'm like, I can't. I'm on the treadmill. I'm doing Zwift and stuff. And there's so many things like that. Like Paula said, that is once we're done with this like incredibly devoted, dedicated lifestyle, it's going to feel like one big weekend for a little while where we get to catch up on all these things that we've wanted to try and have never had time to do.
I wonder also if it'd be hard to go back into the age group scene and like be paying so much money to do this. Because like It is so expensive to enter races, and you'd have to suddenly like buy all of your own stuff, and no thank you to that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. We feel a little appreciated, Paula. I appreciate that.
Well, that could be one reason. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of like, why has no one done this? You're right. I don't even know one pro who's gone and raced age group.
I have one theory here, which is, you know, okay, let's say me. I keep racing until I'm, let's say, 75, and I love it. And then at the end, I'm like, you know what? I'm done. I finished. You guys have done 10 lifetimes of training by the time you're 35. And so that 75, you reached that when you were like 20, and you had to break through that barrier and keep going like, nope, I do this. I keep going on. I keep training, even when I don't want to, even when I want powder days. I didn't go out. I didn't go on vacation. I did this thing.
I do wonder, though, if like we could probably train at like 25% of what we're training right now and still win age group races. Do you think that's possible?
Is it about winning? Like, do you think once you're no longer a pro, you're going to care about winning age group races, or are you just going to care about
doing... Yeah, maybe not. Maybe then you would feel like a fraud. You'd feel like, okay, why am I doing this? This is embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's a complex ethical dilemma.
I mean, I would like to go volunteer. I would like to continue doing what we do with the development team. I would like to continue that triathlon life as a brand and everything. I still want to be around the sport and everything.
That's what I think is the coolest. It's not just that, but like... We go to races with Ironman and like Paula Newby Fraser is our athlete liaison and Belinda Granger is doing the announcing and like people that
Marina Carfrae is doing, it's like everyone.
Yeah. I would love to be involved in that capacity. Like you're still there, you're still in it. We love the professional side of racing. We totally understand what it takes to be the best at it, but we're done with that and we're at peace with that, but we can still be there. And I think like being there from that angle would be super fun to me.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
I've said this before, but that's what's kind of interesting about the podcast is that you two aren't just other pro athletes that did well. Like people now feel like they're connected to all three of us. And in 30 years from now, people are going to remember that they listened to the podcast every week and we're kind of like up to date on what was happening in your life and your racing and your training and your hardships and your injuries and stuff. So it's kind of like you are forever connected to the sport. And to me, in a much deeper way.
If we want
to
be, yeah.
I don't think it's if you want to be. I think it's the ship has sailed.
No, I think if we fully like retired and went off social media, we would.
It would be sad.
It would be fine. It would be totally fine. Everyone would be fine.
I don't think I agree with that, but I guess that's just a difference in our opinions.
Well, we'll find out. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned for me quitting the pod.
20 years, yeah. and then finishes with, many thanks for sharing your incredible journey with us all and hope you all have many successes this year. All the best, David from Sydney, Australia. It's quite an international question bank we have this week.
Yeah, it is, huh?
We got a lot of questions this week, by the way. Appreciate that. Keep those coming. We'd love when we can pick from a lot of questions.
And if we don't answer it this week, maybe we'll answer it another week, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Next question here is from Sarah, new pod supporter, longtime listener. Ooh, Sarah, thank you for being a pod supporter. Really appreciate that. Hi, TTL team. I have a wetsuit question regarding shorty suits, shorts on the legs instead of full suit for petite individuals. I really need that buoyancy in my pelvic realm and often cut so much off suits on the legs. Is there any major disadvantage of a shorty suit as long as it's made for triathlons? Thanks, as always, for the humor, Sarah. What do you think?
How shorty are we talking here? Like above the knees?
Probably, yeah.
I mean, I'm just thinking like this is...
That's too short.
From the hips and below is where you want the wetsuit more than anywhere else, you know?
Yeah, in a perfect world, you would wear only pants. Right. Only wetsuit pants.
No, I just think that I don't know like a single wetsuit brand that makes... Because when I think of a short wetsuit, it's like shorts and also short sleeves.
Yeah, for swim run.
And I feel like that would be... It's just really hard to get the same quality of wetsuit and speed that you're looking for with a wetsuit without the full arms and the full legs. And also just warmth. Like a lot of the time, we're not just wearing wetsuits to be faster. They seriously serve a purpose. And a lot of the time the water is freezing and you want a full wetsuit. So I don't know. They do make very small wetsuits for petite people. And I think cutting the ankles is a really good option if it's too long. But going all the way to shorts, if you're buying a wetsuit anyway, is not what I'd recommend.
Yeah, that almost defeats the purpose.
Yeah. Sorry, Sarah.
What it is good for, though, is if you're... I used to do this at Commonwealth Pool in Victoria. It was so cold, like the 50-meter competition pool. So some of the people I trained with would wear those shorty wetsuits just to train because it was like so cold in the water. So they serve a purpose potentially, but not for racing.
Ah, yes. Okay. Okay. Next question here is from Catherine from Zurich. Dear Eric, Paul, and Nick, I have a question about training when time is limited. I will be giving birth to my second baby in March and have 70.3 Wisconsin scheduled for September. Let's go, baby! Deferred from 2023.
Nick's doing that too, right?
Not the 70.3, baby. I'm doing two of those back to back.
The full.
He's doing the real race.
No, it's not real. It's going to be real hard. I feel confident I can get the training in for run and bike, but probably won't be able to swim 3 to 4 times a week like before with a baby and a toddler. If I can only swim once a week, maybe twice, what is the biggest bang for my buck in swim training? I'm an experienced triathlete. I've done a full and many 70.3s and Olympics and sprints, so not overly concerned. However, I do want to get enough swim training in to finish the swim without panic. Thank you for all that you do. Love the pod. Catherine from Zurich. So what's a good once a week kind of focus for someone in her position?
Eric doesn't know.
Duathlon?
No, that's not true. What I thought of when I read this question.
This is insane.
No, what I thought of when I read this question, once a week is totally fine. Stretch cords go a long way. And we all discovered this during COVID when we were in lockdown. Remember that, Eric? We didn't swim for like a month and we were fine. I don't know. I just think that like if you're going to the pool once a week to get the feel for the water, your best bet for that session is to do as many meters as you can in that session. Like don't mess around with doing like drills and sculling.
Yeah.
Is my thought.
Yeah.
And then when you're at home with the baby and the toddler and the busyness, you could do like 10 minutes of 1 minute hard pulling with the stretch cords, 20 seconds off, 10 times. It takes 15 or 20 minutes. And I do think you get strength from that. And we all did it during COVID. So worst case scenario, I would for sure try to swim twice a week. Once is so little, but twice, if that's at all possible, like mix it by going to the gym and swimming for 2K and then running on the treadmill or whatever it is. But twice would be optimal.
Yeah.
In either way, still like trying to get as many strokes in as possible instead of like drill work or like 50s with long rests in between. It's like, no, keep the effort lower to be able to get in more swimming. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I do think there's a place for like speed work and sprinting where you do take more rest. But what I'm talking about is just like being very diligent in the pool and not talking or taking more rest than you need and just being very focused for that time that you are in the water and doing like best average sets of 100s, for example, on short rest are really good ways to get fit in the water when you're on a time crunch. Is that true?
I mean, don't look at me. I'm not the person asking about swimming.
I've never had a baby. I have no idea. That is an incredible undertaking. And I'm just so impressed that you're going to try to do a 70.3 in the middle of that.
That's true. That is really amazing. Impressive. And if you're an experienced athlete, this is what we found during COVID is that all of our years of swimming experience really never went away just because we didn't swim for 2 months or whatever it was.
Totally. Yeah. If you have any sort of background in swimming, I think this will go smoothly. If you're learning to swim this year,
then it's harder.
It'd be a struggle.
Also, Catherine, if you see me in Wisconsin, say hi. I'll remember this question. I promise it's in my head. Catherine from Zurich.
Oh, she's from Zurich and she's flying all the way over here for that race?
Yeah.
That's also crazy.
Yeah, Catherine's a glutton for punishment. Okay, next question here is from Peter. Hi, TTL. Peter from the UK. Thank you for all the podcasts. They keep me company on my morning walks. I'm a keen runner, but I have never completed a triathlon. Is 74 years young too old to try one? Running and TTL have become my friend since my wife died 2 years ago. I run 4 times a week. Your advice would be great. Kind regards, Peter. 74. Peter. I love it. I love it, Peter.
Some sad stories this week.
No, I'm sad.
Well, thank you for sending in the question. Also, thank you for listening to the podcast, considering you've never done a triathlon.
Yeah.
That is really cool to us. You are for sure not too old to do
one. No, you're good to go. I think we've seen like at 70.3 worlds, like an 80 to 85 year old age group world champion.
Especially if you're like active still. And It's really never too old. And I think that's one of the cool things about triathlon is you don't have to go in and do an Ironman. You could go do a sprint distance. You could try an Olympic. You could do things that are local. There's a lot of welcoming opportunities for someone who's new to the sport to come in and do it, regardless of their age. Totally. And that goes on the young end. It goes on the old end. And another thing I realized as I get older myself is that 74 is not even that old.
It is crazy how our perception of age has really changed.
Yeah. I'm like, my dad is in his 60s. I used to think that was old, but he's like totally fine and fit. He could do a triathlon tomorrow. So I think there's a very big range of like people's health at different ages. But in my mind, 74 is not that old, and you can definitely do a triathlon. And we would love to hear about it if you do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I'll say too totally. That my dad, who has kind of toyed with the idea of doing a triathlon, he is older than 80, and he recently went to his heart doctor. And that's what I would tell you to do, by the way, Peter, is see a heart doctor or maybe just a general doctor and tell them, hey, I want to do a triathlon. How can I make sure that that's a good idea for my body? They'll totally. Be able to tell you if it's like, okay, we'll set you up a couple of tests. Maybe we'll do a EKG, like a stress test, and see how your heart responds, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, that's a really good advice, Nick. Even us as professional athletes, to get our international race card in Canada, we have to do a test like that.
So
it's a pretty good idea for anyone to do that, regardless of their age, just to make sure that you don't have like some kind of a heart condition or like something you don't even know about.
Yeah,
it might be a risk if you're exerting yourself really hard.
Yeah.
In Italy, even as an age grouper, you have to get cleared to race.
Mm.
Not just as a professional.
Interesting.
Peter, it's going to be very fun. Triathlon's very, very fun. Just make sure that's the priority, is having fun.
totally, yeah.
Okay, next question here is from Joe. Hey, Eric, Paula, and Nick. Hope you had a great season so far. It's real early, but it has been great so far. Could you give us a rundown of your backcountry ski/splitboard setups? Also, I know Paula mentioned having a dedicated Ski-Mo setup in addition to her backcountry gear, and as a gear nerd, I will happily hear about as much as you are willing to share. I also think that, Nick, you're mildly disgracing your heritage by not joining on some tours. Italy is the home of the hut-to-hut ski tour. Congratulations on an amazing year, both on and off the race course, and have a great 2024. Actually, he said 2025. Joe, you're a little ahead of yourself here, but... okay, so what is your ski splitboard setup, Eric? For example,
I have a Cardiff Snowcraft Pagoda, which I love. It's the it's only the second snow split board that I've ever used, but I think I got super lucky. I got it because it was supposed to have a very surfy, like playful feel. And then I got Voile bindings, and I don't know what brand my boots are.
They're K2.
K2. Like backcountry specific boots. So they feel pretty good to walk up in. I can crank them down with the boa a little bit when we switch to downhill. I'm pretty psyched on the setup. The only thing I haven't quite figured out yet is the perfect set of poles. I kind of want like longer poles with longer grips, but the longer the grips, the less, you know, small the poles get to put them in your backpack. And I would just always carry my poles while riding down, except I'm also trying to carry a camera for three
while
we're going downhill. Right. So my setup is extremely complicated. I will say that the one coolest thing, piece of gear that I've seen lately that I really want to get is our friend Nate has, is it Joelbo?
I never heard of the sunglass brand, but I think it's called Joelbo.
Yeah. So Joelbo, I had heard of this brand. I just want to make sure that I had it right. They have these goggles that you can wear while walking up and then riding down, and they actually like pop off your face.
You tell
like,
me about this.
Flow.
Yeah.
By like 3 millimeters, just so they let it flow through and your goggles don't fog, and then you just like kind of click, put them back on. And so you don't have to take your helmet off and your transitions are super fast. Don't have to take your goggles off. It's all great.
That's cool. And do people, like when you're talking about your setup, is, you know, like on bicycles, tires matter a lot. For the kind of skiing that you guys do for the touring, do the type of skins matter, or is that kind of like, no, they're all the same?
Oh, good question. I don't know. I think that probably in Ski-Mo racing, where it's really critical to take them off quickly, like while the skis are still on, they're very light because they're just, everything is about weight. You want to minimize weight. But for the type of touring we do, I don't think that the skins make a huge difference. I've had skins for like 8 years and they're still good.
Oh, wow.
There are definitely different prices of skins.
Yes, so there's different prices.
The companies would definitely want you to believe that there's a big difference.
I would say like a ski purist would definitely be rolling their eyes right now and saying, yes, there's a big difference. But all the ones I've tried have been good and feel similar.
We don't go on days that are super gnarly to where like having a 1% better skin is going to like make the difference of you being able to go uphill or not. We don't, if it's like crampon required skiing, we're probably not doing it. So
yeah.
Got it.
We're pretty light on our gear.
And what about Paula's setup?
I'm probably like the person who, relative to the amount they ski, has way too much freaking stuff. Because I just am obsessed with buying skis. It's so weird because I don't even ski that much. It's just like my guilty pleasure is skis.
Skis are Paula's drones.
yeah, exactly.
Except you guys use your drones. I just like look at my skis because they're so
beautiful.
The
skis are in the videos.
I do ski. But what's so funny is I've bought so many new pairs of skis over the last couple of years, and I still go back to my Scott 95 width skis that I got like back in 2010 because I just love them so much. So I don't know, 95 is kind of like a good overall all-round ski. But I also bought a pair of, this is how stupid this is. I don't even know what brand they are.
You got DPS like 110s or something?
I got DPS 110s, like super wide skis, because I borrowed a pair when we went on our heli ski trip last year, and they were so beautiful and so nice. So I bought a pair this year with Dynafit bindings. And then I also got a set of new Salomon super thin ones to use for going uphill fast. But they're not skimo skis. They're kind of like an in-between. Like they're light ski, but they're not like a crazy race ski. And I think those are like a 78 or an 82. So I got the full fleet of weights. And I think that we're probably boring most triathletes on this topic. So,
well, anyone who's interested in it just got all their cheat codes. So you're welcome.
Yeah, I will say that the Dynafit or like the pin style bindings for anyone who's interested in a touring setup are definitely the best that I've experienced.
I have nothing to add to this topic, fortunately.
The thing with skiing, though, it's kind of like triathlon, I would imagine, as an age group athlete, is there's always more shit to buy.
Right, of course.
Like, oh, I need a fancier backpack to match with my fancy ski pants, to match with my 5 different jackets I have for different weather conditions, and then my helmet that I use for uphill and my helmet I use for downhill.
Oh, yeah.
And my goggles that pop off my face. It's like, suddenly you're spending... Maybe that's why I like it. We don't have a sport where we're spending all of our...
For fun
money.
Yeah. No, we don't have any gear acquisition stuff, you know, like satisfaction from triathlon.
Yeah. So skiing is that for me. I just need to go more often.
Yep.
Okay.
Cool.
Thanks for the question though.
Okay. Next question here is from Guy. That's officially his name here. What's up TTL fam? I'll try to keep the questions short and sweet. What is your plan for this upcoming season with the PTO series and the new Ironman Pro series? I'd love to hear a bit about what you are all planning for in terms of races this upcoming season, especially with the two main road pro series. Wishing you all the best this year. Thank you for all you do in the triathlon community.
I'm all in on the PTO, baby. All in.
You say all in, but that's not strictly true.
It is.
Are you? So you're not doing any Ironman races this year?
I signed the contract, Nick.
It's not like you can't do any Ironman races if you do the PTO series.
That's what I'm saying here. So you're saying you're all in, but you're still going to do some Ironman races potentially.
Yeah, I think I'll do a couple 70.3s. The way that the PTO schedule is laid out, which has not been released yet, it is quite spread out over the year and it goes all the way till the end of the year. So there's a lot of opportunities where there are gaps in the schedule where I could fit in a race like a North American 70.3 race, which I really want to do because I love Ironman racing. It is, the 70.3 distance is different than the PTO racing. So I think it's fun to mix some of those in. And it's really also fun to go back to races that we love, like Chattanooga, St. George, Oceanside. Like we have these good memories there. We know the courses. So anytime I can fit in a 70.3 in between the PTO, I'll definitely do it. But when I say prioritize PTO races, I definitely mean that. Like
that's
what I'm taking the most seriously. So that's my plan.
Eric, what about you?
I don't know. It's really a tricky season for me because I am not highly ranked enough in the PTO thing to like get a wild card or anything like that. So none of those races are an option for me. I'll definitely be focusing more on...
Not that you'd want them to be, really, though.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. I mean, if I really wanted to get into the PTO series, like, I would have had to live my life slightly differently over the last couple of years.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, just, I mean, train a little bit differently, do less mountain biking. You know, Paul and I might have gotten in more fights on bike rides and stuff. So, yeah. I'm really happy with where I'm at and everything, but I'll be... probably doing a couple of North American 70.3s. I'd love to get back to Santa Cruz. I'd love to do Tremont Blanc again. Oceanside and St. George are just like classics, which we really like, and we really like the community there. But I just have to decide if I really want to do those courses again or not. And then the thing that's really making me the most excited this year is going and trying to win Xterra Oak Mountain, which is North American Championships for Xterra.
And then go to Italy for Worlds.
Yeah.
For Xterra Worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting. It's the first year where our schedules will be potentially quite divided, but I don't think that's a bad thing. Like we experienced last year, I went to some of Eric's races where just he was racing. He came to mine where just I was racing. And I think having that kind of division in roles when we're at these races is nice. And it's quite challenging for us both to go and race at the same event. It's definitely doable. We've done it a ton. But it's not all bad that maybe we're dividing a little bit in our schedules this year.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've been there firsthand, and I think when both of you are racing on the same day, it causes like a cumulative stress for both of you. Mm-hmm. That's obviously not healthy for racing, or at least not helpful.
I just feel like it's more of a game of compromise, and you can't be... compromising if you want to race at the highest level in 70.3, and certainly not the PTO these days. And we have slightly different ways that we operate on race week. And if we're both doing the exact same thing, then somebody is compromising at any given time.
Well said. Okay. Last question here is from Jackie. Hello, relatively new to triathlon, but feel like I've dived in head first and catching up on all TTL episodes. Love your work. Quick question for the team. I just qualified for World Champs in Nice after my first Ironman. Very stoked for a 10:30 with a handful of weeks on TT bike. That's great, by the way. My question for you, do you think Nice is best suited for a TT or a road bike with clip-on bars given the elevation? Do you think the only time it's worth using a roadie is when there's lots of twists and turns on a descent rather than the elevation? Thanks, Legends. Hopefully you can come to a race in Australia someday. I knew when she said Legends, I knew she was Australian. I could feel it.
Absolute legend.
Legend.
This is an interesting question. We've both raced in Nice at the 70.3 World Championships. Just for context, we're not totally guessing here. We've actually done that course. What would you say, Eric?
There's a little bit more to the Ironman course, obviously, than the 70.3, but you start and finish the same way, I think, with going up the Col de Vence and then... coming down the...
I don't even know if they go up the Col de Vence in the Ironman.
Oh, really?
But either way, okay. It's like the nature of the roads there, we kind of understand, so...
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like the year that we raced there, Gustav Iden won on a road bike. So I think if you're significantly more comfortable on your road bike than you are on your TT bike...
For the descents.
Yeah, for the descents and also potentially the climbing.
Yeah.
This could be one course where that might be the better thing. And that if that also sets you up for a better run, yeah, I think it's kind of on the line. I say the same thing with Alcatraz. With Alcatraz, if you're as comfortable going downhill on your TT bike as you on your road bike, might as well ride the TT bike. But if there's a huge difference there, then go with the road bike because it can be hairy.
The funny thing is that we always say always triathlon bike is faster unless you're on some course like Nice and then maybe the road. And here we are where that's the real situation where it's world championship and people are trying to decide what's going to be faster for them.
I think that on that course, for professionals, the TT bike for sure is better, especially for an Ironman. There are a lot of parts of that course that you will benefit from being aerodynamic versus as light as possible. And I think that the better technology and bikes and better braking with disc brakes and wheel choices, you can still descend really well on a time trial bike. maybe more than 10 years ago or 15 years ago on a time trial bike. So it's very feasible to do that race on a TT bike. And I think the biggest thing is just getting time on it and practicing on it. And if you're on yep. a TT bike for 2 weeks beforehand, that's going to feel a little sketchy. But if you can ride your TT bike as your primary bike for months and months leading into it, practice on windy roads, that's definitely the way to go, I think.
Yep.
Agree. TT bikes are better for usually for storing nutrition, for carrying water, all the things you need in an Ironman. So it's, I think the bigger question is like, do you go disc wheel or no disc wheel? Maybe.
Mm.
That's interesting. What I was going to say is that I think people underestimate how much aerodynamics makes a difference, even on a course where you're twisting and turning and climbing yes. and braking a lot. Even totally. In like a hill climb, you have to get pretty steep before you should be prioritizing weight over aerodynamics. It mm-hmm. really makes such a big difference. And my thought was exactly what you said, which is, are you going to be able to descend safely? Are you going to be able to descend confidently on the road bike? Much more so than the TT bike? Maybe that's where it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I honestly think that the perfect bike for Nice is the Shiv TT. Because to me, it rides like a road bike. It feels so light.
It's so light.
Got the disc brakes. It's so easy to maneuver it. It's not like a tank TT bike, but you can get aero on it.
Well, you say you can get aero on it because nobody can buy it. So this is funny. Like, you are sponsored by Specialized, but this is like not, and you're not trying to sell bikes here because you can't get the bike, right?
Well, it's on the website, but it's sold out. They're sold out on the website.
Yeah, but they've been sold out for like a year and a half.
Okay, well, maybe if you offer us enough money, we can sell you one.
Yeah, so try that. Maybe do that.
Anyway, a bike like that, it doesn't have to be, you know, like the UCI legal bikes
yep.
are all kind of similar.
Yep.
And they're lighter than the triathlon bikes.
Yeah, if you're up for purchasing a bike specifically for this World Championships.
Yeah, make sure right. the UCI
right.
bike.
Right. Well, those are all the questions that we had for this week. We're back in the people are back to training, and I know people are back to training because I think the amount people train is directly proportional to our relative downloads that we get on the podcast each week. And they're climbing fast. Holiday break is over. People are back on the grind, training for Oceanside or
whatnot.
Just
to be clear, Nick, that wasn't all the questions we had. That was probably like a third or less.
And I had to pick like a tiny percentage of those that we yeah. did. So
we're sorry if we don't get to your question, but I do read them all. Some of them I just feel like I should reply by email because maybe it's like too specific for the podcast. So what's on tap next? Maybe we'll come down to Santa Monica and train.
Ugh,
out of the snow.
I keep telling people, I'm like, maybe Eric and Paul are coming next week. Keep your fingers crossed. Today I did this epic ride up under the Hollywood sign and all this stuff. And I was thinking how much I would love to bring you guys there. I think you would have really liked the loop.
Yeah, I know. It is crazy because it's like we got this beautiful van that can take us anywhere safely.
But then we have a giant horse to put inside of it.
Right. Okay, Flynn is not the limiting factor. He is a thing, yes, but he's not the reason that we haven't packed up and left yet. I think the reason is because all the drives are so mind-bogglingly long to get somewhere warm.
Oh,
and
yeah.
we did a lot of traveling in our off season. We went to San Francisco to the wind tunnel. We went to Canada for Christmas. We went to Victoria to visit my sister. So we feel slightly burnt out on road trips.
I feel like burned out on driving. I don't even want to like drive up the mountain to go skiing.
Yeah.
Very much, which is like completely different than last year.
And definitely if you're training locations to train, it takes a couple days to get there and then it takes a couple days to get settled and it cuts into a week of training. So right now although we're doing a lot of indoor stuff, we are really on a roll and it feels like we're getting fitter and we're able to all the training. Bleep out, I hate that word.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It just reminds me of She Who Shall Not Be Named.
Yeah, so that's why we're struggling with this decision.
Well, you guys know that I would love it if you guys came down.
Of course we do.
Yeah.
We would love it too. It's just, it is a long way. How many times have you driven all the way up here?
Once.
Yeah, and your car drives itself.
That's true. And I don't pay for gas.
That is one thing that our our dream van does not do. It does not drive itself.
That's what we'd have to do it like in a way where we stop and then we train and then we drive and then we stop and then we train.
But we can't do that right now because it's freaking freezing cold and snow cold everywhere. Yeah. We just have to suck it up and do it all at once, blast through.
Okay. Well, we'll let you guys know what we decide. Maybe next week we'll be coming at you from Santa Monica.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love that.
Do another video pod.
Yeah.
Oh, we can set it up in the living room. Don't get everybody worked up when you can't deliver.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Later.
Bye. Bye.